Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Heck, president and founder of the International Association of Teamwork Facilitators. Today is Thursday, September 10th, 2015. The time is 1:01 p.m. Eastern, and you have dialed in to the monthly IATF visiting faculty member call. Our guest today is David Hutchinson, who is I've known David for a number of years. I'm going to give him a proper introduction here in just a moment, but today's event does include the opportunity to view a web interface where you can use a chat feature, and this will allow you to ask questions of our guest and interact with other audience members. And you can go to, if you're just listening in on your phone, you can head over to the web and at uberconference.com/TomHeck. And you can also find this link at the IATF website, which is www.iatfconnect.com. So a little bit about the IATF. All of our work here at the IATF is designed to do one thing, and that is grow inspired teams. And we do that with monthly events like this, group and one-on-one coaching. We have an online community of facilitators, coaches, trainers, educators from 35 countries, and we also have offer team building workshops. And in fact, I'm going to be mentioning a product that I use from David, developed by David and a colleague of his, that is called Go Team Resources. But maybe we'll talk about that and the how that fits into today's conversation. And so a little bit about David. I'm sure many of you have showed up here today because you read the broadcast that I sent out about David. I met David through a colleague of mine by the name of Barry Relaford, and Barry and David co-wrote a book together. It's one of my favorites, and it's called A Slice of Trust. And it is a must-read for anyone who is working in the field of team and leadership development. David, as it turns out, is an expert at understanding how to use story in the world of business and on teams and for leaders. So he's worked with Coca-Cola, Walmart, IBM, GE, Nike, Bank of America, and many others. Depending on the day that I send an email to David, he might be at his home in Tennessee, or he might be on the other side of the planet, helping a group of people, a group of leaders working on how to use story. And in fact, today's call, we're going to be talking about The Circle of the Nine Muses, a storytelling field guide for innovators and meaning makers. This is just published. I highly encourage you to head over and learn more about the book. And today we're going to be talking about that. You can find David's work at davidhutchins.com. And David, I'm going to be typing in his website address here in just a moment in the chat area. And again, as we go through this program today, I encourage you to ask questions, ask for clarifications in the chat window there. So, David, welcome to the call.
Well, thank you, Tom, for that introduction. And thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to see folks calling in from all over the country and around the world here. It's pretty neat. Well, David, you and I had a conversation in the spring. I came to you with an urgent need having to do with my TED Talk that I was developing and my ability or inability to figure out how to tell the story that I wanted to tell. And so I want to circle back around to that at some point, but there's a question that I'd like you to answer. And that is, and I was reading your book, you write in your book towards the beginning, if you are a leader, you are a curator. What do you mean by that? If you are a leader, you are a curator.
Yeah. And so in the conversation around storytelling and leadership, that really is the best place to start, because think about the role of a curator in a museum. Yeah. Well, what is that role? What does the curator do? And that's rhetorical. You don't have to answer in the chat window. But the role of the curator is to make decisions about the story that the museum will present to viewers. So, women in the Renaissance might be an exhibit. And then the curator says, all right, I'm going to select these pieces as best supporting that story. I won't select this piece. No, I think I'll pick this one. And so through a series of decisions, the curator selects a series of pieces that support a broader story. And that's the role of a storytelling leader. You have tremendous influence over the identity of the organization and the team and the work. And you create that identity intentionally by selecting certain stories, by strategically selecting stories, and then finding opportunities to tell those stories for the purpose of building the organization. And so, this gets to the role of the leader as strategic storyteller, which is where I like to begin with this work, because there's a lot of story people out there who talk about the content of stories. You know, how do I tell a better story? You know, how do I get a nice narrative arc in the story, and how do I identify a protagonist and an obstacle? And all that's good. I have work around that as well. But it's not the first question. The first question is, which stories? Which stories should I be telling? And then how can I purposefully tell those stories so that I can achieve some strategic end or outcome? And so that's really the heart of my work, and that's what Circle of the Nine Muses, the new book, is about.
So I want to follow up on that as to which stories to tell, but maybe you could just tell us what are the Nine Muses? When you say the Circle of the Nine Muses, why? Where does the title come from?
I love it when people ask that, because I barely touch on it in the book. My daughter and I were talking about how how you see retail stores like Old Navy, which have some kind of metaphorical connotation that makes you stretch to say, what does Old Navy have to do with the clothes that are inside that store? There's nothing nautical about it. So in one way, I was going for something evocative and metaphorical. And I don't really describe it in the book. I want people making those connections and interpreting what it means. It is influenced by Greek mythology, where the nine muses are the source of knowledge and wisdom. And, you know, I can't name all nine of them off the top of my head, but, you know, one of the muses is the muse of history, and one is the muse of poetry, and one of science, and one of music. And the idea is that the muses spread their wisdom and their knowledge through the stories that they tell. And there's even an old legend that when Pythagoras visited Croat and was consulting with that community, he recommended they build a shrine to the muses at the center of the public square, so it could be a place where people could come together and tell stories and hear stories, and in the process build community and receive wisdom and spread knowledge and define what does it mean to be us. And so those are all things that happen when we tell stories. And of course, the circle is the timeless construct. When we come together and we face each other face to face, without computer screens, without technology, but just eye to eye, and we receive one another's gifts of story, it can be a very powerful experience in identity and meaning making. And so those are some of the things I connect to the title, although I've heard people say, make other connections that were fresh and surprising.
So can you give us an example, David, of, I'm going to take a step back. In your book, you write, and I was just reading this, about how it's very rare or maybe non-existent, you can clarify this, that someone in the business world comes to you and says, hey, can you help me tell a better story? And so instead, what do they ask you? And I'm wondering how you, so you view the world unlike I do, but maybe I'm realizing I do it more like you do, which is through story. When someone comes to you and says, I need my team to feel a greater connection with each other, I need team unity, or and you look at it through the lens of storytelling, how do you make that, how do you help somebody make the jump from here's what I want and then helping them understand the power of story to answer their problem?
Right. You know, the thing that's powerful about story is it connects to so much of the work of the organization. You know, it's an operating system. It's not an end. It's something that takes you somewhere else. So, Tom, it depends on what the question is that the client is asking. Actually, I have had a few say, I need to tell a better story. You know, I've got a big speech coming up and I don't like my story. Can you help me make it better? Mm. And so there's certainly kind of a presentation skills, public speaking kind of element to it. You know, how can I increase engagement? How can I have an audience on the edge of their seats? So that's one application. But it also connects to so much. You know, my background is advertising. I started as a copywriter working in big ad agencies in Dallas, Texas, and then in Atlanta, Georgia. And so that's an old idea that brand is a story, right? So there's a lot of work being done right now in connecting story to brand building. There's a engagement and team development is a huge topic. You know, a lot of teams are looking for purpose and identity. Who are we? What work are we about? And especially in, you know, millennial generation, does that work connect to my highest aspirations? You know, I have friends in talent acquisition and talent management. They say that young people are using story language now. They'll come in for an interview and they'll say to the interviewer, so what's your story? What's the story of this organization? And I've had people in talent management say, I'm not sure how to answer that question. How do I answer a question like that? And so, you know, that language comes into, you know, it's about identity. There are also applications to knowledge work. What is the wisdom that we have within the organization? And especially as baby boomers are getting closer to retirement age, you know, industry is about to have a mass knowledge crisis as the baby boomers all leave all at once and they take decades of priceless wisdom with them. Mm. You know, not information, not data. You can put those things in a spreadsheet, but wisdom, the hard-earned stuff. And it turns out that story is the container for that kind of information. So the work of knowledge management is saying, how do we capture that wisdom in a format that we can do something with it and that we can access it and spread it and benefit from it? So those are a few of the applications and just a few of the ways that we can connect story to the work that we're doing in the organization. That's kind of a big sprawling answer there.
That's okay. So can you give us an example of an organization that you helped with story? So what you have here is a group of people from all over the world who work with teams and work with leaders. Help us understand how what your work looks like on boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the partnerships that I have, you mentioned overseas, I have a partnership with INSEAD, which is a global business school. They're headquartered just outside of Paris, France, in Fontainebleau. And they have an executive education program like a lot of business schools do. And so they bring in a lot of Parisian companies like you know, Louis Vuitton and L'Oreal and Danone, the yogurt company. In France, it's Danone. So there's a lot of applications in an executive education kind of context. And there, a lot of it is, how do I engage my people? How do I, you know, as a leader, my job is to say, we're going this way, everyone come along with me. Well, story can help with both of those processes. You know, how can I use story to define where we're going? And then how can I use story to engage people and get them excited and connected to the work? So those are some of the things that we talk about. You know, another question that has come up more than once is big organizations, especially those with strong brands, a lot of them will confess to you, you know, I feel like we're losing our story. You know, the thing that we were about at the beginning that was so energizing and meaningful and important, now we're making a lot of money and we feel like we've lost that story. What do you do when the story is lost and when the organization becomes something else? And that becomes really interesting conversation as well.
So you mentioned that story is the most efficient container rather for wisdom. And you write that story is the brain's most effortless path for parsing information. Why is that? Why is story so useful when compared to just writing out sort of the raw data of what's going on? What is it? What's going on in our brain that makes it such a powerful tool?
It's the oldest path to influence for sure. I mean, but you know, PowerPoint is, it feels like PowerPoint has always been haunting us, but it's actually a very new technology. You know, it's the campfire construct, and you know, I've seen detailed treatises of evolutionary theory of how story is an efficient way for the mind to make sense of the world and to store emotional information and information about conflict and change and survival. You know, those are all complex messages, and story is an efficient way to lodge them in the neural networks of the mind. There's actually a lot of neuroscience and brain theory around this. I bet our audience has read some of this, how, you know, there's a theoretical construct called mirror neurons, which says that when I tell a story and when you hear a story, we're having an identical experience. So that if you took a brain scan of my brain as I was telling the story, it would be lit up like a Christmas tree. And then if we took a scan of your brain as you were listening, it would be lit up in a nearly identical pattern. So that you are quite literally having a parallel experience. And that's called mirror neurons. And that's why, you know, when you see a video of a laughing baby on YouTube, it makes you laugh and feel joy as well. You've emotionally coupled with the baby, right? Mm. And so that same thing happens when you tell a story, or at least when you tell a story well. It's possible to blow it so that doesn't happen. But that's the opportunity, is to create just enormous understanding and connection and engagement by telling stories.
So there's this. Clearly, I think that we all get that stories are powerful, and what I hear you saying is that we're engaging different parts of the brain when we tell story versus just saying, here's, for example, in your book that you wrote with Barry Relliford, A Slice of Trust, which I mentioned previously, right. The principles that you're trying to teach can be boiled down into probably a page. But you took a book to tell a story. What's the, it's the same information, is it not?
Right.
The one right. page versus the story?
Right. So I'll go back even further. So one of my first books was in the late 1990s. It's called Outlearning the Wolves. surviving and thriving in a learning organization.
Yes.
And it's a similar book in that it's a fable. It's actually even crazier. It has talking cartoon animals in it, and it introduces disciplines of organizational learning, consistent with the fifth discipline in the work of Peter Senge and the Society of Organizational Learning. And that book actually began as a project for the Coca-Cola company. And in the early 90s, they had made a system-wide initiative of becoming a learning organization. I mean, they were among the early big companies to really seize on that. And early in the work, they came up against a challenge, which was when they went around the world and within Coca-Cola talking about this idea, nobody understood what they were talking about.
Mm.
You know, if you've read the fifth discipline, it's transformative work, but it's also very challenging, and it can be kind of academic and obtuse. Or at least many people experience it that way. And so, I was a communications guy living in Atlanta at the time, and they asked me to help them with a communication solution to help people understand what is this abstract idea and why should we feel urgency around it? Why should we feel enough urgency to change our behaviors, which, you know, is what nobody wants to do, right? And so, you know, I really stumbled into the solution by accident. How do you describe a learning organization? And so I can't even tell you where the inspiration came from, but I, created a page on my computer in Microsoft Word, and I wrote, "Once upon a time, there was a sheep." And I wrote a silly story about a flock of sheep that outwits a pack of hungry wolves. And in the process, they become a learning organization, and they display many of the capabilities and possibilities of organizational learning. And the book went on. You know, we eventually sent it to a publisher, and now it's like in 12 languages. I mean, it just keeps selling more than almost 20 years later. And that was really my first almost accidental experience in this work. Wow, when you tell a story, it brings, it puts flesh and bone on abstract ideas. Because it has emotional information, it engages my emotions in a way that I don't just rationally understand, but I feel the importance of the material.
So this is good. Now, I want to bring it down to a practical sort of hands-on. We've got all these people here on the call. And by the way, I want to encourage everyone to, we've got the chat window open. If I realize some of you might be calling in, dialing in from a phone and not engaged with or have a screen in front of you. But over here on the Uber Conference website, uberconference.com/TomHeck, that link also is at the IATF website. You can find us that way. But we've got a chat going on the right-hand column. You might have to click a little window to be able to view it. So please write your questions in here for David. And if you'd like, if you would rather ask a question just verbally with your phone or through the computer, you can do that, and I'll be able to unmute you. So, David, help us, give us a practical, here's something you can do tomorrow with the group that you're leading. And it's either, you can choose whether it's an individual or if it's a group of people. But I'm wondering if you could take a skill from the book and teach us how to use that and under what circumstances we would use it.
Good. Okay. And also, I want to echo, I would love to have the audience's questions, just so everyone knows that, this is not scripted. We can take this anywhere you want, which is more fun. So the book Circle of the Nine Muses is loaded with very practical, actionable things that leaders can do to bring the wisdom of story into their teams and into their work. And, one of the end outcomes of this work is to create an interpretive community, a culture or a team that is able to hear the story and begin digging into the story and saying, that story has something important to say about us or who we are or where we are going or how we do what we do. So the book is loaded with ideas for finding stories, for sharing stories, and then for drawing meaning out of stories. And it's all very fun and actionable and lots of flip charts and sticky notes and sharing stories. And it's very energetic, engaging work. But one of the first principles in the book is, how do you bring people together to share stories? So I think it's chapter 2, actually. How to host a story circle. And, you know, if a bunch of us were to get together after this evening, after this conference call, and if we all agreed to meet for drinks somewhere at some central location, which I guess would be in the middle of the ocean, but if we all agreed to meet for drinks, you know, we would just start telling stories about our day, and we would start laughing, and then soon everybody would be bursting with stories they want to contribute, because stories release more stories. But in an organization, that doesn't happen. Something different happens. And I think it's because when we come together in a meeting, we're looking at the agenda and we're aware we only have 30 minutes. And so the space required for narrative to flourish frequently doesn't exist in organizations. So the whole second chapter is, how do you create that, you know, Starbucks calls it a third space, you know, a space that's not necessarily task-focused, but a space where we can just kind of meet and come together and hear one another. And that's why Starbucks says they are successful. It's not just the coffee. It's they created a third space similar to the classic salons of France, which became hothouses of social reform and big ideas. You know, it's a place of coming together and conversing differently. Well, you don't have to go to Starbucks. You can do this in the conference room. And so they're just, you know, it's bring people together. I like to remove the tables and just sit in a circle face to face and then begin. How you ask for a story matters. You know, you can't say, so today I want to talk about trust in teams. You know, why is trust in teams important? You know, a lot of the questions we normally ask won't elicit stories. People say, oh, trust in teams is important because it's efficient. Well, that's not a story. So there's a whole third chapter in the book, which is, how do you ask for a story? So tell me about a time that you experienced trust in teams in a way that really impressed you, that, you know, just in an unforgettable way. And allow people to start sharing their stories. And it's the simplest thing in the world. I mean, it's not much more difficult than what I just described. It's just about being purposeful about it. And then when those stories start emerging, then there's, of course, lots of things that you can do with it. But it starts with the intention, and then just creating an experience where you can ask for and then hear the stories that your team members have, and then be amazed at the wisdom and just the depth of meaning that comes out in those stories. It's really an invigorating experience to do that.
So, David, if I had a room full of, could you do this with 200 people in a room?
I've done it with 200 people, yeah. I've done it with, I've been in, you know, big conference ballrooms with hundreds of people in it. And it scales upward very easily. Yeah, I like to put people in groups of 4 or 5. So you just need more chairs and it's going to be noisier. But otherwise, it's exactly the same.
And so now everyone's sharing stories, and I guess like what you said is true, is when someone shares one story, that probably triggers a thought in someone else, and maybe someone who was stuck and not remembering a story now remembers the story. Is that a common occurrence?
It's that's a nearly universal occurrence.
Oh, wow. So
yeah.
how do you manage, whether it's 20 people or 200, what's one of the things that you do as a facilitator with once everyone's through telling a story? Give us an example.
So once we're done telling the story, and in the example I just gave, these would be spontaneous stories.
Sure.
You just came together and everyone told a story about, let's say, trust. Now there's all this information in the middle of the circle about trust. Yeah, that is the question, Tom. What do we do with that? And, the subtitle of the book is A Storytelling Field Guide for Innovators and Meaning Makers. And this is where the meaning-making piece comes in. And once the story has been told, one of the things I tell leaders is that that's not the end of the work. A lot of leaders think that telling a story is the end of the work.
Mm-hmm.
I've told my marketplace a story, now they should buy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the story is always the beginning of a conversation. So now there's all these stories, and this is where we say to the team, wow, there's a lot in there. How do we begin to draw that out? How can we find the meaning? How can we find the gold that really says something about who we are? And so I've got lots of practices for that as well. There are some, at the simplest level, there's some listening constructs that assign roles to the listeners in the group. So, there's that whole second role. We always focus on, I don't even like the word storytelling. It puts the person who's doing the telling in the spotlight, and it ignores that whole second half of the interaction, which is the listening and meaning making. And the truth is the listener actually has more power in this interaction than the teller does, because the listener can now begin weaving together some connections and some meaning. There's one construct I use that's very simple. It's called the harvester witness construct. So, Tom, you'll tell your story first about trust, and then Joe, you'll be the harvester, and Jane, you'll be the witness. And the harvester says, I heard something in your story. I made some connections. Your story said something to me about our organization. I heard some assumptions in there. So the harvester is inside the text of what you said. And there are even some simple kinds of harvesting questions that you can equip that person with. But people are able to step into that role quite quickly. And then the witness, the harvester's inside the text. The witness is behind the text. I noticed something about you, Tom, as you told that story. I noticed that when you talk about your team, you become very impassioned. I can tell you care about them. I noticed something about us as we heard the story. I noticed how we were all leaning forward, and my heart started racing when you got to that exciting part of the story. So it can be anything about the phenomenon or the experience of the story. And so between being within the story and then being outside the story, now you as the teller are having a really amazing experience hearing just the dividends of meaning that you had no idea were in that story.
Yes.
Now you're thinking, all I did was I just told you something that happened to me, and now all this gold is being spun from it. And so the harvester witness construct is one very simple way to invite the team into that meaning-making conversation.
I think I'm going to go back to a question that Lorraine in New Zealand asked, and she says, I am more of a logical person than a creative person. How do I tell a better story? I think what I'm hearing, what you say here, is that being able to tell a better story as a leader is important. It's a critical skill nowadays. And from a facilitation point, what I'm hearing you say here is that I'm not necessarily in the scenario you just laid out, harvester witnesses, I'm facilitating the storytelling. I'm not necessarily telling the story. I'm helping others. I'm drawing out the wisdom within the group, which is what facilitators do really well, coaches. Is that not true?
That is true. So tell me again, was it Elaine?
Lorraine.
Lorraine. What's Lorraine's question? How do I tell a better story?
I am
story?
More of a logical person than a creative person. How do I tell a better story?
So I love that you asked this question. This is one of my favorite topics. And, you know, there's a lot of work being done right now in how do we bring narrative to science-based work or to engineering work, and how do we connect data and narrative? I mean, there's some fascinating thinking right now. Lorraine, here in the United States, there's an organization called the Alan Alda Center for Science and Storytelling. And I know you didn't say science, you said logical person, but it's the same phenomenon. Alan Alda, of course, was the actor who played Hawkeye in MASH for decades. And now he has this organization where he is actively involved because he loves science, and he wants to teach logical, left-brained people story skills because it's part of, if you're working on a new molecule in a pharmaceutical organization, at some point you have to tell a story and engage people and bring people along into your work, people who don't understand it, right? So there's a lot of things you can do to connect the left brain and the right brain and begin spinning your work as a narrative. And my guess is that when Lorraine goes home and has dinner with her family or with her friends, she naturally starts telling stories. Well, I had a frustrating day today, and let me tell you what happened. And, it may not, be something you want to put up in a competition in a spotlight. You know, it may not be dramatic, but it's meaningful. And so that's why I always say to leaders, even if you don't tell the story well, if you tell the right story, it can have enormous implications for your work. So I would say to Lorraine, start by telling stories that are core to the work that you're doing without thinking about structure yet. Chapter one of Circle of the Nine Muses focuses on the four core stories. These are the four stories you should be telling, even if you don't tell them well. And it's the stories of identity. You know, who am I? Who is this organization? What is this project? What is the nature of this work? So there's identity. There's values stories. This is how we do what we do. You know, we say we're about excellence and quality. All right, what does that really mean in this organization? Tell me a story about a time that quality was at its best in this team. You know, once you tell that story, now the value is loaded with meaning and vitality. So identity, values, stories of vision. You know, where are we taking our work? Where is this going? Those are challenging because that's a story in the future. How do you tell a story about something that hasn't happened yet? And there's a lot of ways to go about that. And then a huge opportunity for leaders is stories of change and learning. You know, a time that I tried something or the team tried something and we didn't get the results that we expected. And here's how we're updating our mental models and our beliefs and our assumptions so we can get different results. So those are the four stories. So as a logical left brain person, those are the stories you should, this is where we started in your role as a curator. You should be finding these stories as they relate to your work, identity, values, vision, change, and learning. And then as you collect these stories, find opportunities to share them and tell them. And when you do, you have an enormous leverage to advance your work and to advance your team and the organization, even if you don't tell them well.
I've got a question from Scott here in just a moment. But when a group goes through a process like this, David, where they're essentially telling stories and curating stories and making meaning of the stories. What is a typical outcome? What do people say? Because I'm going to imagine that if they hear, oh, we're doing storytelling, and this guy David's coming in to facilitate this, they're going to think, oh, touchy-feely. So on the other side of it, though, once they go through this, what are some common comments that people make?
Afterwards, you mean?
Yes, afterwards.
You know, it's funny because, you know, since when you tell a story and hear a story, it is emotion. I mean, the word emotion keeps coming up, and that's a big part of the work. And so when people tell and hear stories in groups like that, they feel this charge of connection that they don't normally feel in their work. And they feel, you know, in at its best, it can create a closeness or a unity with the people in that you're sharing with. So at the end of the experience, people often will say that it was profound, or that they've never experienced that in a training program before. And it's not because I delivered it so brilliantly. It's because of what they experienced, and what a rare and precious thing it is for people to bring their whole selves into the work like that. You know, I'm discovering that people are hungry to bring their whole selves into the work and connect to the mission with their own mission. And when you give them an opportunity to do that, it just unleashes gratitude and energy. It really is. I love this work because as a facilitator, it's not that hard, and yet it's incredibly powerful. It's a really fun thing to do.
I know that from working with you and the energy that you have around it. Scott writes a little bit ago, he says, what about consciously, and this is, I think what triggered this was maybe the harvester and witness conversation we were having, or story you were telling, process rather. What about consciously selecting someone to play the role of devil's advocate to improve the perspective and understanding of the situation? Does that question make sense to you, David?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I find that I don't have to choose someone. When I tell a story, and this is another one of those universal experiences, especially if I tell an organizational story. If I tell a story about how the organization began, for example, what was true back at the beginning of, I like to use General Electric as an example, you know, because it started with Thomas Edison inventing a light bulb, or I tell some Walmart or Coca-Cola stories since I've worked with both of those organizations. And there's usually the devil's advocates emerge on their own. I don't even have to assign it. And it's no reason to be defensive when that happens, because that's the story phenomenon. Whenever I tell a story, people in the audience are going to be testing the story and testing me. And they're going to be saying, does this story match my experience? Does this ring true? And, you know, especially here in America, we're already in a presidential election cycle, even though it's a long ways away. But we're seeing how candidates manipulate and spin stories, and most people have a rage reaction to that. If people feel like they're being spun or manipulated by a story, the response can be rage. And they will let you know, and they'll say, all right, I heard your story. Let me tell you how I experienced the story. So that's a natural part of this process. I don't know how to manage that in political dialogue, which I think has become poisoned. But in organizations, that's the work. That's the opportunity, is to tell stories, and then kind of in a yes and with a spirit of yes and, okay, who else has a story about that? Your story might sound different. Let's hear your story. And then we're starting to create some broader meaning from all these different lenses of the kaleidoscope.
Well, and Scott points out that that if we assign someone to the role of being the devil's advocate, it ensures someone will do it. Plus, they do not get blamed for being the devil's advocate, because I'm going to imagine in a situation like that where you have conflicting stories, if you will, one's positive, one's negative, and that someone can be seen as sort of the glass half full, glass half empty type of person. So what is the truth? And, someone can be seen as perhaps the person who's being a party pooper.
Right. I might be reluctant to assign a devil's advocate, partly because that person I think would take a different role. And when you say devil's advocate, I think the temptation would be to say, well, wait a minute, you said this story happened on a Monday. It was actually on a Wednesday. And, and then the devil's advocate will start poking holes in the facts of the story. And I don't see that as being a generative conversation. I would rather the devil's advocate to say, yes, I heard your story. Let me tell you my story. My parents do that all the time. My dad will tell the story about that time he ordered the salmon on his honeymoon, and my mom will hit him on the shoulder and say, no, it wasn't the salmon. You ordered a steak. And I mean, she starts disagreeing with the details of the story. And my dad always has the perfect response to that. He says, now, Pat, this is my story. Let me tell it my way.
It's
And he's exactly
funny that you
right.
say that. Well, I have an older brother and a younger brother, and when we get together, when we talk about an event, it's funny how each of us has a different story about that event. And I'll say to my brothers, I don't remember that part. And they'll say the same to me. Or
And
there will be embellishment.
so which one of you is wrong in that case?
That's a good question, right?
Right? Which one
It
of you is
reminds
wrong?
me of the three people who are blindfolded feeling different parts of the elephant.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah. So I want you to talk for just a moment about the book for facilitators, because I feel like this book was written for people like us, the people who are on this call or who are going to be listening to this recording. It is true that you wrote it for people who are in the role of facilitating and leading and working with groups. This is true, right?
Yes, and I actually make the bold claim that even if you're not a facilitator, if you're a leader of a team, which doesn't necessarily make you a facilitator, that you can take these ideas and work with them. And so I've done my best to present them in a way so that people who don't have the skills of people on this call, that most leaders can say, all right, I can ask for a story. I can have a conversation about a story. But that said, there is some more advanced material in the book that I think does require facilitation skill. And so the idea of the book is I reached out to story practitioners and knowledge workers, some of the top thinkers in this space all around the world. And this includes people from knowledge management at IBM who've done a lot of pioneering work in story. There's a guy in Washington, D.C., who's been recognized by Congress for his work. He does story work with young leaders from the Middle East, Palestinian and Israeli young people who've been raised to hate each other and destroy each other. How do we bring them together and tell and create a different story? And so, it's work that has been tested in some of the most innovative social enterprises and organizations all around the world. And my collaborators were just enormously generous in saying, yeah, I'll share with you what I know works. And so the book is loaded with practices that are informed by the practice of story thinkers all around the world. And so my hope is that this represents, at least today, where the story space currently stands. Collectively, this is what story thinkers have figured out and what we know is working, and then translated in a way that you can bring it to your team.
I love it. So I know also I got one final question for you, and it has to do with you know that I'm very involved in the world of experiential learning, and but before I ask that question that it has to do with storytelling and experiential learning, I want to mention to everyone that to encourage you to head over to David's website, which is davidhutchins.com. And David's last name is Hutchens, davidhutchins.com. And you've got a free download there, correct, David? If you could describe why someone would want to get that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The download is actually an introduction to those four core stories. So I only briefly said, here are the, as a curator of identity, here are the stories you should be looking for. The download provides some more insight and some more nuance. Here's how to think about those stories. And then also includes even a worksheet for, you know, most people will say, I can't think of any stories like that. Well, yeah, yeah, you can. You have dozens of stories like that. So there's a worksheet that will help you begin to surface the stories that you didn't even know that you knew.
Yes,
so yeah, that's
great.
Available for download.
Free download. So, all right. So I've been thinking about our conversation the past couple of days, about today's conversation, and thinking about one of the reasons that I love experiential learning and getting a group of people playing a game together. And, you know, Scott Zimmerman, I see some other names who are here on the call with us who have helped groups play games together. Sometimes they're, like in Scott's case, a very interactive board game. And then there's also, you know, for me, I'm engaging people in group problem-solving events, and might even include, you know, a half day or a full day of these experiential learning pieces. And as I thought about this, David, what came to me is that this experience, you pull all of these people with all of these different experiences about team, and then we ask them to join together and work more effectively together, but they don't share a common story, a common language, and an activity or a series of activities can help create that sense of story, although I've never used that phrase necessarily. I'm wondering if I should be more conscious about how I move into that area. Is this? And I know that in your Go Team resources that you've developed, which is a fantastic product, if for those of you, you can find the link at David's website, davidhutchins.com, but you include experiential activities in there. Is one of the reasons that you do that so that we can create a collective story?
I think story creation is the ultimate end of this work. You know, when we bring people together and ask them to tell stories, that those are typically going to be historical. You know, if I say, tell me about a time you experienced trust in teams, you're going to be looking to the past and you'll tell me something that happened, you know, 2 years ago. Which is great. We can still use that to catapult us into the future. But the created story, the shared story, and the future story are some of the ultimate acts of story leadership. And you're exactly right. When we bring people together, we are creating stories that are going to define who we are. You know, I talked about the origin story is a common story. For, you know, that it's one of the core stories. What was true at the beginning of the organization? You know, when we tell that has DNA of identity in it, and they're really powerful. Origin stories are really powerful. Well, every time you begin a new project, you're creating a new origin story. So you get to be purposeful about creating that story. And that's why a lot of teams and leaders, when they're beginning a new initiative, they'll bring people together maybe in an offsite or, you know, do something that's very symbolic and metaphorical. And it's because you're creating an origin that's going to define who you are going forward. You're creating a story that people are going to tell. And it's a very powerful moment when you do that. So again, there's ideas in the book about how to be purposeful and bringing in some archetypal kinds of thinking for the stories that you're creating in real time.
I love it. Well, I know that we have at least one person on this call today who's ready to go out and get that book. I think it's Lorraine in New Zealand who's wrote, she's already purchased the book and can't wait to read it. All the way from New Zealand. Good job. Well, David, I so appreciate your time and your willingness to share your wisdom with our group of facilitators and coaches from around the world. And this, I think, is some of the most important work we do, is helping people. As the more I realize this, the more I've worked with you and understand that there's a system about storytelling, both as a leader and with groups, that we can actually facilitate this. And as you said, it's not that hard, and yet it is so powerful. I'm realizing that maybe that's really what I do when I go to work with a team, is, you know, I help them define and put meaning around their shared experience. So for that, I'm eternally grateful and just really appreciate the work that you're doing. Really glad that you've written this book.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. I always love working with IATF, and you are a jewel of a collaborator. So thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I want to thank everybody who dialed in today, and for all the people who listened to the recording. Thank you for taking time to be here and listen to this recording. And if you're interested, there are other recordings with David at the IATF website, and you can access those. You can just search the website and you'll find them on other topics. So again, David's website is davidhutchens.com. His last name is H-U-T-C-H-E-N-S, davidhutchens.com. You can find that link to his website at the IATF website. This recording will be posted soon, and you can feel free to share it with your colleagues, friends that might be able to benefit from this. So thanks again, everybody. I look forward to talking with you soon and hope you're well, and continue your good work out there. Bye-bye, everybody.